Saddle up your horses. Well, warmest of greetings, everyone. Delighted you're here. And in this opening podcast, why don't we take a few minutes and look at the first half of Book 1. First half of Book 1 of the Psalter. And let's begin with a couple of preliminary matters, shall we? We'll start by just overviewing really quickly the story of the Psalter and talk about five books that correspond to five periods in Israel's national journey. Then we'll look at Psalms 1 and 2. We'll spend a few minutes on these opening psalms and suggest that they form a gateway not just to Book 1, but in fact to the entire book of Psalms. So number 1 and 2, I think we'll single out for special attention. And then, as we scan the first half of Book 1, why don't we single out four or five examples and just look at them and come up with a few points of each to orient us to the first half of Book 1 of the Book of Psalms. And full disclosure, I appreciate from the get-go that reading the Psalms as a book with a plot is going to be a new thing for many of us. I think especially folks who've kind of grown up in church or spent a long time studying and praying with the people of God, often the Psalms are devotionally used, various metaphors are chosen, and you often hear the phrase, every human emotion is found in the Psalms, and so as a result, they're applicable to a host of different situations, and people draw on the Psalms in various ways. The idea of a book with a plot, though, to me, allows for the opportunity to keep everything that we perhaps has meant a lot to us in the Psalms, but really I think provides a much more compelling meta-narrative. And reading the book as a five-part drama that corresponds to the history of Israel, I think has a lot to commend itself in these days. So let me start by just quoting, actually, a recent commentary who answers this question. There's three commentators who work together on this particular book, and when they're asked, what's the shape of the Book of Psalms, they respond, it's five books that narrate the history of ancient Israel, the very history that's recorded in the books of Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and the prophets. Books 1 and 2, so that's Psalms 1 to 72, really, isn't it? Book 1 is 1 to 41, and then Book 2, 42 to 72. Chronicle the reigns of the kings like David and Solomon, and give us this portrait of the monarchy. Book 3, Psalms 73 to 89, tells the story of the dark days of the divided kingdoms and eventual destructions. Book 4, Psalms 90 to 106 recalls the years of the Babylonian exile, during which the community of faith had to rethink their identity as God's people. And Book 5, according to these commentators, that's Psalms 107 to 50, celebrates the community of faith's restoration to the land and God's sovereignty over them. Ancient Israel and emerging Judaism survived in the world of which it found itself a part because it found in its past, a way to make sense of the present and the future. Now, I'm not sure that's the best written paragraph, but it does provide a summary of these five books, and I think you and I might slightly modify that a little bit. We love the idea of a five-book drama, but perhaps we'll shift the focus just a little bit. And over the next week, why don't we just try out this theory? So, what we have in Book 1, again, Book 1 is composed of Psalms 1 to 41. And I think what we might argue is that what we see here is the installation of the monarchy in Jerusalem. So, Book 1 is going to take place mostly in the city of Jerusalem. And it's going to focus on the crisis and some of the problems and the turbulence that are associated with kingship. Now, Book 2 is going to continue this story. Book 2, of course, Psalms 42 to 72. But in a lot of ways, it's going to focus on the failure and the collapse of Israel's royal leadership. This will be foreshadowed from Psalm 42 onward. There will almost be kind of a negative backbeat, and impending doom seems to be almost a subplot in Book 2. Now, what we see is in Book 3, it's by far the darkest of the five books, because Book 3 is located in the midst of exile and the gloom of forced deportation. The Israelites find themselves dislocated from the land, and they have to try to make sense of their faith in an extreme minority position, having been taken into captivity. So if Book 3 has a bit of a negative slant, that would be the reason. Now, Book 4, it seems to me, is a return to the covenant, a falling back on the great traditions of old. Book 4 signals a new hope, and of course it's followed quickly by Book 5. Book 5, this book of restoration and fresh anticipations. New things that God's going to do in the land seems to be part of the hallmark of Book 5. So I think what we have in this drama really is a soundtrack to the faith of Israel. There were thousands of psalms, but what we have is 150 that are compiled as the greatest hits, and they're put in this intentional order in order to help us hear the music of Israel's faith over the ups and downs of these five major periods in the history of God and God's workings with God's people. We'll come back to this notion, so don't think this is the only time we're going to talk about it, but there's a quick overview as we are opening our discussion today. Now, the next thing, let's look at Psalms 1 and 2 now, and we'll call these the gateway to the Psalter as a whole. So not only are they the point of entry to Book 1, but what we're going to say is this is really the gateway to the entire performance, the whole five-book drama. This is our point of commencement. So we're going to talk about the opening psalm that one commentator says appears to encourage an attitude of constant delight in and meditation on the Torah as a guide to life rather than the opposite, rather than to death. If Brevard Childs is correct, this is Gerald Wilson quoting his old supervisor, in fact, then the placement of Psalm 1 intends to focus the reader on the following psalms as Torah to be read with the same sense of delight and of diligence. And furthermore, Psalm 2 is a royal psalm that's going to provide a breathtaking image of divine kingship that transcends the nation, and Israel's monarch is going to be the object of hostility, but this monarch will ultimately not be defeated. Now then, Psalm 1, and let me translate it if you don't mind. We won't do this very much over the course of our journey together, but Psalm 1 is a big one, so I'm going to render the following translation if you don't mind. Let's just look through it real quick. You can compare with another version if you like, but here would be my rough rendering of Psalm 1 that begins, "Oh, how blessed is the one who, in the counsel of the wicked, does not walk, along the path of failures does not linger, and in a chair with cynics does not sit, but whose delight is in the Torah of the Lord, and in the Torah meditates day and night. This one will be like a tree transplanted near streams of water, that brings forth its fruit in season, whose leaf does not fade, and in all that is done, such a person prospers. Not so are the wicked, for they're like chaff driven by the wind, and therefore the wicked won't stand in the judgment, nor failures in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked disappears." That's my rough translation. Now just a few points on Psalm 1. And let's begin with that term, blessed. There's a couple of different ways to understand the term. Some commentators note that the term blessed is derived from the verbal root to go straight or to advance, that is, along a road or a pathway. So rather than some sort of ethereal feeling, sort of like, wow, I'm feeling blessed today, rather, it's the direction that you're going in life. That would be a blessed way, the right, the advancing kind of direction. Another way commentators understand the term blessed is, if you're blessed, you've been given a gift. So somebody who receives a gift and then opens it and enjoys it and is consumed with happiness with respect to that gift, that's a blessed person. So you could probably hang on to both ideas for the moment. And the blessed person, of course, is immediately contrasted with a cast of characters, the wicked, the failures, and the cynics. Now, who are these characters? Let's start with the wicked. In 2 Chronicles 19, a prophet accosts King Jehoshaphat. Now listen to me. Jehoshaphat's a king who had it all. He had wealth. He had glory. Seemed to love the Lord, but then he made a catastrophic move. He allied himself with the northern house of Ahab. And the prophet in 2 Chronicles 19:2 upbraids Jehoshaphat. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath upon yourself? The wicked, at least according to this reading here in 2 Chronicles, are not Canaanites or Perizzites or Hittites or Cellulites or any kind of outsider. The wicked are, in fact, Israelites here who know the right path and do not take it, who deliberately distort and pervert the way for their own gain. And the wicked, of course, are these characters in the story. Now, no doubt, there's a wider net one could cast, but just in that particular case, the wicked, of course, are insiders who act like outsiders and, as a result, fall woefully short. So that's one kind of character in this opening song. The second, literally, are sinners. Now, I've translated it as failures, because I'm trying to bring out the idea of missing the target, missing the net. If you have a little Timbit hockey player and she's skating down the ice, you know, has a breakaway on an empty net and, you know, shoots it wide, that little Timbit, why, she's a sinner, unfortunately. You know, she missed the target. That's a funny example for something rather more serious. But really, the failures are those who do not hit or shoot accurately. Sin is initially described in Genesis 4 in a rather arresting way. God warns Cain. An absolutely arresting metaphor. God warns Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what's right, won't you be accepted? But if you don't do what's right, sin is laying in ambush. It is crouching outside your door. It desires to consume you, but you must master it. That's the first instance, by the way, of the word sin in the whole Bible. We don't have it in Genesis 3, but we do have it in Genesis 4. And I'm connecting it with the idea of failure because you must master these dark and devious impulses. Sin is toxic. It will destroy you. Once it sinks your teeth into you, it doesn't let go, and it'll absolutely destroy your life. So really, a failure is one who's been consumed by sin and has not pursued any kind of self-mastery. So that's another cast, or member of the cast of characters here in Psalm 1. The third, and this is all from the opening verse, of course, with various action verbs, blessed is the one who doesn't walk, stand, sit, note the progression there, or I suppose even regression. Third category is, I'm translating, the cynics. The scoffers, I suppose, is another way of rendering it. These are the kind of folks who are noted for their skill in abusing language. Specifically, they're vicious in their words. They often use double meanings, cutting taunts. And really, if one of the marks of being created in the divine image is that we're able to use words in ways that are beautiful and creative, then the cynics seem to abrogate that divine image, and they use words in awful, in self-serving, and in abusive ways. So what we see is these cast of characters, these wrongdoers, contrasted with the one who delights in the Torah Adonai, who delights in the special revelation of God. And what will such a person be like? such a person's going to be like a tree. And of course, trees, a repository of great biblical symbolism. That's why we've got the tree of life, for example, earlier in the story, and the tree of life, which is symbolized by the lampstand and the sanctuary. The tree of life in Genesis 3 is contrasted, or at least is kind of put in opposition to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as you recall. And, as we may have talked about in other courses, what do these two trees represent in that story? Well, it's not just a one-off prologue, but rather this is the drama of every human being's day-to-day life. Every day we're faced with various kinds of choices. Are we going to make choices that are under the aegis of the tree of life, that is, words that God says and endorses? Or are we going to opt for self-centered decision-making mechanisms, do our own thing and freelance, and decide for ourselves, in essence, what's good and evil and what works for me? So you see, these two trees in Genesis 3 are two choices that confront us. I said every day, but it's probably closer to every hour. Such a person who is rooted in the Torah becomes like a great tree. You see, you become as your choices dictate. So if you're constantly choosing from the tree of life, you're going to resemble a tree itself, one that's firmly rooted. And when the inevitable storms come, it'll be difficult to dislodge you because you are well anchored and you have been transplanted, really. You've been taken from somewhere not so good and you've been planted by rivers of living water. So you can kind of see that almost Exodus image. You've been brought out of slavery, brought out of a dismal place, and given an opportunity to flourish. Again, these are just a few thoughts on Psalm 1. And in fact, commentators often draw a connection between Psalm 1 and Jeremiah 17. Jeremiah 17 says, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the one who trusts in man, who makes flesh his strength." I'm reading from the New Jewish Publication Society version. "Who makes mere flesh his strength and turns his thoughts from the Lord. This person shall be like a bush in the desert, which does not sense the coming of good." Jeremiah 17, "Such a person set in the scorched places of the wilderness, a barren land without inhabitant. But blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord alone. Such a one shall be like a tree planted by the waters, sending forth its roots by a stream." So, whole host of parallels between Jeremiah 17 and Psalm 1, this great sort of wisdom invitation to live your life a certain way under the guidance of God's word, rather than the dictates of the crowd that we so often find ourselves immersed in. Just moving toward the end of the psalm, who are you when no one's watching? I mean, that could be the title of a best-selling book, I suppose, but in Psalm 1, we're told that God knows, watches over, is intimately acquainted with the way of the righteous. Rather, the wicked who are driven, I think as John Chrysostom talks about, driven by every wind of temptation, and there's almost a franticness scurrying about. The wicked, that is, those who are the authors of their own fate, are on a different path, and ultimately, it's a march of self-destruction. They autonomously move toward their own judgment. And the curious thing is, that's why I've translated it kind of literally, the way of the wicked, eventually it just vanishes. It disappears. It's got no long-term sustainability. It's got no future. Now, I just want to efficiently look at Psalm 2 and make a couple of remarks. Again, here's my rough translation, and follow along with the translation of your choice. Verse 1. "Why do the nations rage, and the peoples murmur emptiness?" That's the same verb for meditate. Blessed is the one who meditates on the Torah, meditates on the Torah day and night. Here there's meditation, but it's on emptiness. Verse 2, "The earth's kings, they take their stand. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed one, saying, let's tear off their restraints, throw away their ropes from upon us." The one seated in the heavens laughs. The sovereign one derides them. Then he speaks to them in his wrath, in his rage, terrifies them. I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will announce the Lord's statute. He said to me, "You're my son. Today I've brought you forth. Ask me, and I'll give the nations as your inheritance, the ends of the earth as your possession. With an iron staff you'll break them, smash them like a potter's jar. So come now, O kings, be smart, and receive instruction, O judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and celebrate with trembling. Kiss the sun, lest he get angry, and you perish in the way, because his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." Now, I want to back up for just a sec, because it seems like there might be some odd images there. There seems to be the inauguration of kingship that's somehow alluded to or commented on in Psalm 2. I want you to go back to 1 Samuel 8 just for a moment, because this is where the Israelite leaders, the elders of Israel, make a request for a king. "Give us a king," they say, "just like all the other nations." Now, this is something they may not have, or at least should have thought twice about, because, of course, Israel already has a king. When God's bringing them up out of Exodus in Exodus 19, he brings them up on eagle's wings, he says, "And you are for me a holy nation. You're a kingdom of priests." So they already have a king, and asking for one in the mold of the other nations almost seems like an abrogation of that status. In the end, there's over 40 monarchs of Israel in Samuel and Kings, and none receive a passing grade. They're all failures of various magnitude. So I think you could probably summarize and say the royal experiment in Israelite historiography doesn't end well. And yet, what we have here in Psalm 2 is almost another perspective. The Israelites are asking for a king out of their own self-interest, and yet God takes that precipitous and disastrous request, and what we're learning in Psalm 2 is that he transforms it into a redemptive possibility. And what God's doing is establishing the possibility of a messianic kingship that's going to come from the very line of David, of course, that we meet and that we hear the guarantee concerning in 2 Samuel 7. So I think you get a powerful, almost countervoice to the Israelite monarchy here in Psalm 2 that, of course, in the day-to-day maelstrom of life reminds us that there's just an inevitability of conflict, and there's raging among the nations. It's not always easy to remember that God laughs at these things when we're kind of caught up in the crossfire, and yet that's the perspective that we're being given as a gift here in Psalm 2. So what we learn from this psalm, especially when we put it together with the first one, is that upheaval is going to be inevitable with these raging and these murmuring nations, and they'll try to thwart God's plan, and yet will never be finally successful. What we also see is that all kinds of injustices are under the eye of God. This is going to come up numerous times in the Psalms. Why do so many people seem to get away with corruption? And yet, what we have here is almost a bit of a theodicy. We'll talk more about theodicy, and if you need me to explain it, I gladly will. But what we're being called to is kind of a faithful perseverance during times of adversity. I've already gone on a little long here, but just two summary observations on Psalms 1 and 2 from a couple of different commentators. The first is reflecting on the two ways metaphor that greets us at the very beginning of the Psalter. Two different ways you can go, right? The way of life or the way of the opposite. And let me just read a few lines from Richard Clifford. "By their actions, people put themselves on one of two paths. The righteous," and that means, at least the way he's defining it, those who are literally right with God, so it's not like, you know, you're perfect, but rather you're in right standing with God. People put themselves on one of two paths, the righteous path or the wicked path, and each way has an inherent destiny or fate. Those on the right path flourish, those on the wrong path perish. Divine action affecting people on the paths can be expressed directly by verbs with God as a subject or indirectly by passive verbs. Psalms 1 and 2, he concludes, portray the dualism in dramatic symbols. A flourishing tree versus dry and driven chaff. The true king of the world versus a group of plotting and doomed kings. So that's Clifford's take on this opening gateway. One other commentator, I'll just quote it real quick, says that when you consider these gateway psalms, what you have is the Psalter itself becoming this magnificent... The Psalter itself becoming this magnificent dramatic struggle between the two ways, the way of Yahweh, his anointed king, and the company of the just, and the way of the wicked, the sinners, and the evildoers. So really, it's this dramatic contest. It's this, I suppose, this great adventure between two different pathways on this journey in the Book of Psalms that starts, of course, in Book 1. So now, very quickly, let me just comment on, say, five examples of psalms from the first half of Book 1 to give us a flavor of the kinds of material, the kinds of poetry that we'll encounter here in this first book. Let's kick it off with Psalm 3, shall we, which in the first instance is a David psalm. Now, we'll talk about this at length, but you can either see that in terms of authorship or you can see it in terms of genre. Some of you are going to be too young, but back in the old days, what we had was video stores like Blockbuster. And what you'd do is you'd walk in and you'd see various sections of the store. So there was drama, there was comedy, there was utterly pointless drivel. Anyway, these various sections. Psalms of David, likewise, are a genre. You approach a Psalm of David with certain expectations. There's going to be a royal kind of character figure. Somebody, don't forget the name David means the beloved one, so often is kind of a representative Israelite. A lot of Israelites, in fact, see themselves as David-like figures, you know, somebody who's chosen with great potential, but somebody with flaws, and they're kind of battling external enemies and, well, battling internal desires and dark forces as well. So it's a complicated genre, to say the least. In a David psalm, what we often have is turbulence. God is available, and God can rescue you, and when that happens, my goodness, you celebrate. In David psalms, you have to remember something. Just because you're somebody who's living under God's promise doesn't mean you're going to get an easy, carefree, and luxurious life. Not at all. In fact, just as Psalm 2 forecasted external conflict, what we have in Psalm 3 is internal conflict, as David's own son rebels against him, and later tradition connected the events of Absalom's uprising with the particular words in this poem. So what happens is we read the story of Absalom's rebellion in 2 Samuel, and then our response as a community is to pray the lines of Psalm 3. Why don't you fast forward through 4, 5, 6, 7, and pause on Psalm 8 for a moment, which immediately, one of these psalms is not like the other. The ones I just mentioned, 3 to 7, often have petition, or there's a crisis, some sort of emergency. But Psalm 8, on the other hand, the poet almost takes a break, walks out of the tent, and looks upon the amazing creation. I was just reading a book the other day that talked about 2 trillion galaxies, and I confirmed this with one of our science profs. 2 trillion galaxies. So the poet's kind of staring out into space and coming up with a remarkable set of insights that are put to music and preserved for us in Psalm 8. In the grand design of creation, humanity occupies a majestic position. Sometimes you might contrast this with other works of ancient Near Eastern literature like the Epic of Atrahasis. And comparable ancient Near Eastern stories where humanity is at best subservient and even a nuisance to the gods. what we have here is the royal dimension of humanity and a unique anthropology compared with a lot of ancient Near Eastern neighbors. Back in Genesis 3, despite humanity's wayward choices, at the end of chapter 3, even as they're being exiled from the garden, humanity's clothed in royal garments, despite disobedience and despite the fact that they're going on a long march to exile. So I think that it's that sort of majestic view that is granted in this remarkable composition of Psalm 8. Bear with me for just two more minutes, if you don't mind, and fast forward to Psalm 14. And let's talk about the fool who, according to the NIV at least, says in his heart, "There is no God." I might translate it a little differently, if you don't mind, and translate it as, "God does nothing." So I'm not so sure we're talking about contemporary atheists who have, you know, blogs and vlogs and TikToks and, you know, this and that, and, you know, get all sorts of views and likes. Not these self-marketing atheists, but rather somebody who looks around and concludes, you know what? Everybody's getting away with it. Everybody's getting away with stuff. Why can't I? I mean, obviously, God doesn't intervene. Maybe he can't intervene. Fools, of course, they aren't always stupid. I mean, sometimes they are. Sometimes they're shrewd and calculating, but what they lack is wisdom and the fear of the Lord. And so, a question that's raised, I think, in Psalm 14, is the fool an insider or an outsider? An atheist, or maybe, like Hophni and Phinehas in the opening chapters of 1 Samuel, maybe we're talking about corrupt priests who are real insiders and yet acting in foolish ways. Fools believe they can get away with it because they don't think there's immediate divine justice. And yet, commentators warn us, this is a warning for believers as much as anyone else. You see, becoming foolish can happen to anybody who looks around and gets cynical. And so, such a person's warned in Psalm 14 that, fear not, at some point there will be a reversal. There will be, you'll be exposed as having bet on the wrong horse. Sometimes this happens in life, sometimes afterwards, but there will be a reckoning. Contrast the fool with the worshiper in Psalm 15, just for a second. We've got the tent. Who can abide in your tent, your sanctuary? So this is sort of almost an entrance poem. As you're going to the place of worship, you describe 10 actions that are characteristic of a genuine worshiper. And did you notice that? 10 actions, blameless, does what is righteous, so forth. 10 actions. Does it correspond to the 10 commandments? Well, who knows? But this is the ideal worshiper, and I suppose 14 and 15 have to be seen as deliberately juxtaposed. Well, one more example from the first half of Book 1 that'll draw this podcast to a close, and that's Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, in Part 1. In Part 2 of Psalm 19, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. Psalm 19 celebrates, and I may have intimated this indirectly a moment ago, but reminds us that there's two kinds of revelation. In the first instance, there's natural revelation. So God speaks through creation. So a classic example is take the sun and the moon. Now you and I scientifically know that these are disproportionate in size. The sun is like thousands of times bigger. Massive, right? Way bigger than the moon. We all know that. And yet, from the vantage point of Earth, they are almost identical, the exact same size. Do you know what the chances are, astronomically, of that happening? Trillions to one. Like, really, out of this world, mathematics. That would be an example of natural revelation. Now, of course, you could say it just happened by chance, or you could say it was put together by somebody who's got a pretty good eye for symmetry, and that might be an example, therefore, of natural revelation, God speaking through creation. But there's also special revelation, and these are things you cannot know unless God tells you. And the poet of Psalm 19 is celebrating that. God speaks through God's word and gives me insight. And this is something that I want to set my sight on. This is my goal. This is my end game. This is where I want to end up. So celebrates the poet of Psalm 19. A few highlights then from Book 1, folks. Thanks so much, and we'll look forward to picking it up next time.